and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is titled A Stitch of Mine, and it's about, just in general, sewing and DIY culture and just kind of making stuff, maybe versus buying stuff, and how that's just a different dynamic. Our guest for this episode is Lisa Beisinger. Lisa, say some things about yourself.
Hi, I'm a grad student. I sew, I cook.
Where are you a grad student at? And this is important because this is historical.
I'm a grad student at Ohio State University studying anthropology.
The Ohio State University,
actually. Yes,
The has to be in there. They are. Yeah. That. And this is historical because this is the first road episode.
Yes.
Of We're All Gonna Die. This is the first one not recorded in my living room.
So. We're on location.
On location in Columbus, Ohio. No, I don't. Anyway. So, Lisa, you know, we've been friends for forever, but you don't listen to the podcast. Why is that?
Well, I listened to the first one, and I have all the other ones on both my computer and on my iPod. But listening to them is very odd for me. It's very bizarre because we've been friends for so long, since 96. So we've been friends for a very long time.
This is true, yeah.
And so we've had tons and tons of conversation, lengthy ones late into the night.
Mm-hmm.
And listening to you talk to somebody else is almost like this odd voyeurism, like I'm listening to something that I'm not supposed to be listening to, or that I, because you're talking to somebody else.
That's
very bizarre.
That is very bizarre, but I'm sure we'll all agree that that's a totally sane and rational reaction that a well-adjusted adult human being would have. So talk to us about your experience with sewing and stitching, and the cat is about to jump on. Oh, there's a cat here, and it was going to jump on the table, the microphone. Is standing on, which is going to be an amazing sound effect, you know, especially if you have like really shitty 99 cent earbuds that you have to like crank it to hear, listen, make it sound good anyway.
Although, so, now that you've talked it up, she's going to land like a butterfly and the
Yeti
is not even going to pick it up.
We'll see. We'll see what happens. She looks table curious.
She really does.
Yes. All right. So, talk to us about this whole sewing, stitching, like what you do in. Like, your experiences making things, in relation to sewing.
Yeah, a lot of what I've done over time, I self-learned or I learned by watching. My mom taught me how to knit. And before that, she taught me the very, very basics of crocheting, and then I forgot them. And then she taught me how to knit because I needed to knit for a show that I was in, because I used to do theater. For those who don't know.
Yes.
And so I needed to knit for an Agatha Christie show that I was in. And that really was the first time that I really started taking off with the textile crafts.
Yeah. I like the way you put that. Now, how long ago was this, I think, for a little context?
Probably around 98, 99, 2000, somewhere in there.
Okay.
Before that, I do hand sewing. Every time I'd walk near a sewing machine, I'd break it somehow.
Oh.
Like, other people would be using them, and I'd just walk into the room, and all of a sudden, like, oh, I broke a needle! So I was always kind of intimidated by sewing machines for that very reason, because even whenever I used them, I would bind things and break needles.
Yeah, they are. It's weird because those machines, you know, as much as they're sort of gendered feminine, of course, you know, they are kind of scary and violent.
Yes.
You know, and there's like sharp things and mechanisms and levers and kind of sounds that they make. And when it does go horribly wrong, it's quite. Like, I don't think anybody, like, does anybody lose an eye or anything, but it is sort
you
of
you could potentially, if a needle breaks in right the right way. I've actually almost had a broken needle hit my face.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So that is...
It can go flying. And depending on the type of sewing machine you have, a lot of the Singer sewing machines, they don't have a whole lot of power. So even if you do manage to clip your finger, it's going to do maybe one, maybe two stitches that hurt a hell of a lot, but it isn't going to cause any major damage. I actually, before I bought my Husqvarna sewing machine, or my parents bought it for
me. And they also make tractors. Let's just make this.
They make tractors and chainsaws.
It's a company that makes tractors, chainsaws, and sewing machines.
Yep.
So,
well, they
okay,
bought
so
Viking,
okay,
which was a sewing machine company.
Okay.
So they have my sewing machine says Husqvarna on it. It is a Husqvarna Viking Rose.
A Viking Rose.
Which is funny because it goes from being this very masculine Husqvarna Viking Rose.
Yeah, that is great. But that's like a serious machine. Like, you can, like, plug that into the internet or something, can't you?
I mean, I actually can't.
You can watch YouTube on that, right? Or how's that work?
Well, it has a USB card, so I can download stuff from the internet. I can design embroidery patterns on my computer and plug them into the computer and then plug them into the machine. And I hit just a button, and the machine will do all the work for me for embroidery.
Yeah. So that means that then, I mean, so it really, if you can embroider then anything and you can make a digital design, like, you're really kind of free then to make kind of whatever. I mean, if you wanted to do, like, knockoff sports merchandise, I guess you could, right?
Yeah.
You could do your own trucker's hat.
The tricky thing is, Snicket is now wanting to jump up on the other table, and I'm kind of worried about the pint glass over there. The thing is...
By the way, the cat's name is Snicket.
Yes.
I think we ignored that little important detail last time we talked about the kitty. Anyway.
The tricky thing with the embroidery function on the sewing machine, I can't get it to work right now. When Windows went through its multiple mutations over the last few years, the software that I have was built for XP, and I can't get the embroidery software to work. So I haven't been able to use my embroidery function on my incredibly expensive sewing machine for a couple of years,
which
sucks. But I actually mostly use it since we bought it in 2003, I mostly use it for making quilts.
Okay, quilts. Well, actually, you know, I think this is interesting. Well, I'll talk about quilts in a minute, but, you know, you think about, like, and I think this is kind of what I'm getting at with the whole episode, is you think you use, like, Windows or even Apple, because people are like, oh, why don't you use just a Mac to do everything in your life? And, you know, I post on Facebook anything about, you know, my Windows machine or something. Just buy a Mac! You know, and it's just like hatred and whatever. But, like, both of those interfaces, you know, it's weird because it is something where it's very much this attempt, and Windows really gets in the way if you actually know what you're doing, to kind of make things easy for you and make it kind of automatic or make it so that you don't have to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the whole level of kind of interaction that you supposedly have with this thing, and I was, you know, lunching with some grad students not too long ago, and they were like, oh, yes, well, you know, I have to go into debt to buy a really nice laptop and one that's pretty because, you know, we just do everything on our computers now. It's the entertainment center for my whole apartment.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like this, you know, I think that's just such a weird, different dynamic of, well, something invisible will kind of make it for you. Versus a kind of hands-on aesthetic,
yeah.
Which is, I think, what I want to get at with this whole thing about, you know, how sewing is maybe different, or how quilting is kind of, or the, I'm sorry, the textile crafts are sort of different than, you know, the mall world or something. That's,
yeah.
You know.
It's one thing I find interesting, and I actually, I tried in my teens to do hand embroidery. And failed miserably, as you do, and I put it down and walked away. But I don't like doing that. So years and years later, I actually started doing embroidery. And doing it by hand.
So was it
and
like
so it is a completely different feel, because you have more hands-on control over what you're doing, but there are always flaws. Mm. You can't recreate the same thing twice and make it look exactly the same.
Mm. Which is also very but very different from the world. But also, wait, so was this like kind of like a Rocky IV thing? Like, you know, there was like a train embroidery training montage playing in your head. It's like, I failed before, but I'm coming back, man. You know, I'm avenging Apollo Creed's death or whatever.
It was so much more mundane than that. I was doing a lot of road trips last summer, doing research. And I found myself in hotel rooms a lot and not being a clubbing person or a person who likes to go to bars a lot. I found myself in hotels a good bit. And I started doing embroidery as a way of occupying that time.
Mm.
So yeah, I started doing it. Like, I have this book that tells me how to do embroidery that somebody gave me. I probably should start doing embroidery then. And after the book was given to me, I actually bought a whole bunch of embroidery floss, and it was in a drawer for a few years. And I'm like, I'll get to it. And now I design my own designs using the computer again. I do my own cross-stitch designs using the computer, and then I cross-stitch from pictures and stuff like that.
But even then, even though it's computerized, I want to go back to this thing you said about imperfection or the inability to mass produce, which I think is such, you know, we went to the... Was it Ohio Historical Society headquarters, museum, whatever, in Columbus?
Ohio History Center.
History Center. And, you know, there's all these handmade tools, and you think, you know, some of them are maybe 10,000 years old from people from Ohio, you know, people 10,000 years ago making axes and stuff, and then going all the way up to kind of like 18th century, 19th century kind of farmhouse stuff. You know, and that used to be that people, like, if you didn't make it, you couldn't have it.
Yeah.
Or if you couldn't if it was something somebody else made and you bartered for it, then you couldn't have it. But yet, so much of our world is mass produced and kind of immediately perfect, which I find that fascinating because one of the things that always lands with my students whenever I try to bring this issue up in a classroom is how, especially if you work retail or if you ever waiter, waitress, whatever, you know, how easy people now in our world are just go redline anger if the cheese fries aren't perfect or if it isn't exactly the same or you ask somebody to wait 5 minutes. And I worry about that. I mean, the intolerance of imperfection is just kind of scary, but this is the world we make for ourselves.
And
you know?
When you see crafts on Etsy, or you see things that are handmade or designed to be different, things that are embroidered, even in the shop, you'll often also see a tag, imperfections and irregularities are normal for this garment. So if you see a beautiful dyed thing that goes from one shade to another, it'll say that little disclaimer, like, irregularities are normal for this garment. So people don't complain about that, so that they know ahead of time, like, well, this isn't exactly the one that I saw on the website. Well, you know that it isn't going to be exactly the one that you see on the website.
Yeah, and it's weird, too, because I'm processing this in my brain, and a couple things I'm thinking about is, you know, in one way, I think, isn't that more, you're more human, in a way? And that sort of maybe emotional bond, you know, it's sort of like everybody, I think, maybe this is a petty bourgeoisie mid-30s crisis problem thing. You know, everybody has, oh, that shitty car I had in college or in high school or whatever, and the way that you had to, like, kick the door to get it to close right. Oh, I miss that. And those imperfections kind of humanize it, and you eventually are like, ah, fuck it, I want something new that the key turns and it works all the time and all of that, you know. But yet people still, and I think there's some kind of maybe more emotional bond, to a greater emotional bond, I should say, to imperfect stuff. But then, wait, people still do get, like, really into, you know, whatever branded, mass-produced, shitty merchandise that they have, right?
Well, that's what Hoarders is all about, too.
That's what Hoarders is all... Well, but you know what you think about Hoarders is, though, about people finding value in garbage, often.
Yeah.
Or things that... what did the one psychologist, that lady who...
Things that are... People finding value in things that are valueless.
Yeah, and so... I think that's a weird kind of shift, because I always see the people on Hoarders as like, well, they're broken consumers. They're people who, yes, we're supposed to accumulate a lot, and we're supposed to cycle through it. You know, we're supposed to every spring go through the closets and, you know, throw out 8 perfectly good dresses, or maybe if we're charitable, give them away to somebody or some organization. But we're supposed to then go out, and then the idea is you buy 8 more perfectly good garments that you'll wear a couple of times.
There's a TJ Maxx or a Marshalls, they're owned by the same company, so I guess it really doesn't matter.
Yeah.
There's a TJ Maxx or a Marshalls commercial where the woman's like, well, I have a rule that I have to throw something out before I buy something new. And so she throws out, like, a disco ball so that she can go to TJ Maxx and get a new dress.
Yeah.
That there are people who kind of legislate for themselves, like, I have to, or mandate for themselves, I have to throw something away before I get it. But then there are other people who do accumulate and keep and form emotional attachments to things that are valueless.
Yeah, which is, so that's a weird, you know, you can be cynical and say sort of hashtag first world problems, but yeah, this kind of weird dynamic that we all have to kind of negotiate. And I think, is it that people who make stuff as opposed to, you know, people who buy stuff and then throw it away the instant that it's not, because I think there's makers, and I think there's also tinkerers. People who will, like, take stuff apart to see how it works, take stuff apart to make it better, kind of people, too, which is a different kind of way of negotiating the same issue of, you know, how we relate to our stuff.
And there's this really odd thing. I can't remember who the anthropologist was, but he was studying some nomadic group, very egalitarian group, and he started giving them stuff as ways of enticing them to talk to him. And he's like, oh, here's a knife for you, and here's some pots and pans, and here's a pocket watch. And he'd give them stuff to entice them to talk to him. And they'd be all excited about it. Like, oh my God, look at this cool thing that I got. And they'd pass it around to each other. And then a couple hours later, he'd find it in the dirt, just lying around. And the thing he didn't realize, and he was very, very upset that he had given them this thing of value that they should have appreciated, would end up in the dirt. And the thing he didn't realize was, with egalitarian, especially nomadic groups, they can carry all of their possessions with them. The average nomadic person, all of their possessions account for about 25 pounds. And he didn't realize, oh, these people can't value inanimate objects, things that they view as valueless, and carry them with them because it's just another thing they have to carry. If you do value these inanimate objects, that when you're in a mobile lifestyle, you know, it becomes a hindrance.
Yeah.
And also, because it is an egalitarian group, everybody is fairly equal. So people who amass prestige objects are actually seen as seen in a negative light.
Kind of like full of shit. Like,
yeah,
those people are
it's
just
like,
totally
oh,
full
you,
of
you don't need that. Why would you want to carry that with you?
And not to jump topics here, but since you brought
I'd
it
already
up,
kind of jumped
you kind
topics.
Of already did, so we're going to totally jump topics. Okay, so yeah, you're studying... You are an anthropologist.
I am
right?
an anthropologist.
You're working on getting the PhD in anthropology,
mm-hmm.
which is a kind of a weird thing, because you think... Okay, so I always think about, like, do doctors, after they go through Gross Anatomy, when they walk around and see people, are just sort of like, I know what you look... I don't know... Not only can I imagine what you look like naked, I know what you look like on the inside.
And I've actually heard that from some of my anthropology friends who have had to take gross anatomy because they study the workings of human beings and bones. I have a lot of osteology friends who study bones and paleo-osteology and stuff. So they've taken gross anatomy, and like there is kind of the, I know exactly what you look at. I have held a spleen that looks remarkably like yours in my hand this morning.
Yeah, which, so that's kind of weird. It's like one of those, you know, you're unlocking the secrets of the universe or of human life or anything. So you have this kind of background in studying consumption, studying social patterns.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find yourself thinking about things that you do differently? You know what I mean? Of like, oh, this is, like when you are at the Singer making quilts, and we should talk about holiday quilting, especially, in a little bit. You know, oh, this is such an egalitarian, you know, low impact, whatever. You know, like, is there, there's like words for things that you do.
One thing, I actually get my students to do this activity where they do a participant observation at a restaurant.
Okay.
They go to a restaurant and they sit for an hour and record things that they see people doing. And they can have different focuses. One group looked at how people say please and thank you, and people how people order their food at Starbucks.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen in a lot of my evaluations, like doing these activities, doing these interviews, doing this participant observation has kind of broken my brain because I sit and I watch people now and I take really close notice of like what they're doing and how it compares to how other people behave and people who are kind of outliers who do things that are not within the realm of the normal in quotes. And I respond to the students. I'm like, yeah, that doesn't go away.
That doesn't go. So is like pooping different now? Like, you know, pooping. When you think, like, when you poop, is it like, well, this is obviously a you know, something that, you know, people have been doing since the dawn of time and prehistoric. Well, you know what I mean?
Actually,
like, you know, your own, like, waste disposal then? Is that different?
You know, the thing that I think of with the waste disposal issues is because I know so many people struggle. One of the major struggles of people in the world is getting enough water. And so I'm always very conscious of, like, not wasting things and my output. And so with the eliminating of human waste issue, I'm very conscious about, like, okay, do I flush this time?
Mm.
Do I need to waste this water? And I feel guilty when I take a long shower and... Or when I have to throw away the absolutely beyond edible food that I find in the back of the fridge that we all have.
Yeah. Well, there was one comedian.
So I'm very conscious of my waste. And actually, the weird thing is, in the fall, I'm taking a class about the ethnography of waste. And I think
so
that's
all going to be about poop then, pretty much.
Yeah, pretty much in garbology, looking at garbage and what people throw away.
Yeah.
So
which, you think that's the one thing that maybe our culture, you know, it's like ultra suede and landfills as far as like contributions to human progress and you know, because you think when archaeologists are digging us up 10,000 years from now, once they find landfills, it's going to be like, dude, fucking jackpot.
And you know, the thing like, about dude. Landfills is they're so compacted that they become an anaerobic environment. You can, if you dig into a landfill that hasn't been turned, you can find newspapers where the print is still legible.
Wow.
From 60 or 70 or 100 years ago.
Wow.
You can find stuff that is still the way that it was, maybe discolored slightly. Maybe they're not all of it is readable, but you can find stuff. And actually, that's another part of archaeology is digging through middens, digging through the waste piles of past populations.
Yeah. They always do that, I know... whenever they do excavating to build, because downtown Pittsburgh is going through a building boom, and I know there's always there's usually an article in the paper about how, you know, they find the wells and the latrines.
Yeah.
And one of the ways that they used to fill them in was, oh, we got garbage, and then you find pots and pottery and plates and all these kind of broken things, and they become the treasure troves. And there's this one hotel on Fifth Avenue in Pittsburgh called the Fairmont, and they actually have in their lobby display cases of the garbage that was on that site.
Oh, you that's know, cool.
So there's like old whiskey bottles and a corn cob pipe and kind of stuff like that.
Kind of tied to that, I'd been in the anthropology program for a year by this point, and I was on vacation in London, and I went to, I think it was the London City Museum, and they had this exhibit of, it was an artist who was also an archaeologist, and he did digs along the banks of the Thames. So during low tide, he would square things off and dig up things and screen it and save everything he found. And they were items from mostly the last 100 or 150 years. And the interesting thing about this exhibit was that it was an art exhibit.
Okay.
And as I was going through it, it became this exhibit of discovery, because there were all these curio cabinets where they had the glass fronts and then drawers underneath, and drawers that you could open and look at. So it was this discovery, like, oh my God, I wonder what's going to be in this drawer. Pull it open. Bottle caps!
Oh
my God. Oh, I recognized that one.
Yeah, which is a weird thing about museums, because we have a mutual friend who's a sculptor, and one day he had a gallery exhibition, and then we had to go get his pieces back. Like, the exhibition was over, and he had two pieces, and he's like, yeah, I got to borrow my parents', you know, station wagon, and we got to go to this art gallery, and you got to help me carry these, okay? And I'm like, yeah, sure. There's rickety stairs. I'm like, whatever. And, you know, all of the years, just don't touch the art. Don't get close to it. Don't touch the things on display. And there's glasses and sensors. And there's that great art museum in Youngstown, the Butler, that even if you, like, point at something, like the security alarm that goes off throughout the entire fucking museum. Mm-hmm. Oh, don't you ding, you did got close to the art or something. And it's like, oh, God. You know, and so all of that. And so when we went there and the people were running the gallery, and it was like, oh, well, this is in your way. And there's this huge sculpture. And this woman just kind of, like, grabbed it and moved it, and I wanted to scream, hey, she's touching the art, and I realized, oh wait, okay, this is a different dynamic. I'm through the looking glass, you know. Wait, I gotta touch some art. So that's kind of a thing. So it's like, we're this idea of discovery and making and ownership and taking scraps, which yeah, let's talk about quilting.
Okay.
We can get back to sewing, actually, for a second. More poop, no more coprophagia, no more, you know, fecophilia. No, let's talk about quilts.
Okay, so quilts. I when I make quilts, I often buy fabric, which is a very interesting thing, because in order to make things, you need to buy things. And I'm always very conscious of that. That it's like, well, I need to go to Walmart to get the backing for my quilts, or I need to go to Walmart to get my fiber fill for the inside of the quilts, and it's. I'm always very conscious of that detachment between, like, the consumerism and creation, but you need to be a consumer in order to create.
Yeah.
Even with found object art, you are still going through a process of acquisition in order to create.
Yeah. And the found object is something somebody else already made and manufactured, you know.
And then you're repurposing it for your artwork. And I will buy fabric from, like, Goodwill. And, like, sometimes I'll do reclaimed clothing, stuff that I've worn until it's threadbare, because I'm cheap and refuse to buy clothes until they're practically falling apart or falling off of me.
Yeah, I do that, too.
I will occasionally reclaim clothing, or people will give me fabric to make things, and I cut it into squares, and then I make quilts out of it. And I mostly do these squares. I love the look of squares that are built into a pattern. I did last year before Christmas, or I guess it was the year before last, before Christmas, I made a quilt I call a video game quilt, where I used a 8-bit picture of Link from Legend of Zelda, and I made a quilt with Link out of these squares. It was like this pixel thing. And before that, I had done Ms. Pac-Man and two of the ghosts from Pac-Man, Inky and Blinky, as it turns out.
That's awesome. Which in and of itself is, again, that's something pop culture manufactured.
Yes.
But it's kind of yours now.
And then when I create these squares, I have leftover fabric.
Okay.
And what do I do with that leftover fabric? Is it big enough to keep? Is it too small? Do I need to throw it away? I have a drawer that is filled with bits and pieces. And so I took those bits and pieces. I've done two of these quilts where I call them scrap quilts, where I sew together all these bits and pieces and make quilts out of them. And they turn out really neat, although the effort level to get them to piece together, and you have very small pieces that you're sewing together, and the smaller the piece, the more pieces you need to make it into the size you want the quilt to be.
Mm-hmm.
And the smaller the pieces are, the more time it takes to sew them together. So it becomes like this real labor of love. And usually I save the scrap quilts for people who I feel a very close connection to.
Mm.
Like, so I made one for my British mum, the British woman that I adopted when I was living in London a couple of years ago. And I visit her every couple of years and bring her a gift. I made her one of these scrap quilts. And this quilt is made up of the pieces, the reject pieces from pretty much all of the quilts that I have made since I started making quilts. And all of the pieces of fabric that have been given to me. Mm-hmm. And then I inadvertently stole a couple pieces from a place that I was working at.
Yeah. That's the other thing, too, is that when you're thinking about when you're doing this, I'm assuming it is kind of a repetitive thing. You could almost get into that, mindset I sometimes get into when I'm driving, where, in spite of the fact that it's, 2 tons of steel traveling at 65 miles an hour, I'm not really thinking about that. I'm thinking about other things, more important stuff. So I wanted to ask, when you are at the Husqvarna, Viking Rose, away, do you find yourself going into that kind of like turnpike trance? And also, do you think about the recipient a lot?
I do.
I
think a lot about, especially when I'm creating, when I'm choosing the fabric pieces, I think about the colors that the person would like.
Mm.
I made a wedding quilt for a friend of mine. It's like, okay, I know that she really likes pink. He really likes black. Where do I find the middle ground? And that idea, and what colors of fabric go well together? That you don't want too many contrasting colors next to each other. I mean, it's going to be unavoidable to some degree, but you don't want too much of that. So you have to think about that, but once the fabric's kind of laid out for you, it's like, yeah, you can turn off your brain to some degree. Mm-hmm. And then an interesting thing, getting back to the anthropology matter of it.
Okay.
There are certain tasks that women traditionally end up with.
Yeah, gendered labor.
Cultures.
Yeah.
There's gendered labor in almost any culture.
Yeah.
From the egalitarian to the heavily stratified, there is gendered labor issues.
Okay, so wait, egalitarian versus stratified.
Okay.
There'll be emails. There won't be emails, but people will call me, and I'll be like, I don't know, man. I literally asked Lisa. I can give you your email.
Egalitarian tends to be small-scale societies. Almost everybody is related to each other, and everybody's pretty much equal.
Okay.
They might have people who are leaders for certain things, like a person who might lead the hunt, mm-hmm. or a person who might be valued for his input about a certain item or a certain activity. But mostly everybody is equal according to their age, gender. Like the kids don't have an equal say in matters as do the elders.
Yeah.
But generally people are pretty equal.
Okay.
I'm explaining that pretty badly, but you got the idea.
I got the idea. And hopefully the folks listening at home.
Yes. And then we move up through, and we eventually get to stratified societies, which we live in a stratified society.
Okay.
Where there are definitely people in power.
Okay.
And then definitely people who have very, very little say about anything.
Yeah.
In some states, convicts can't vote. Felons can't vote.
Yeah.
At all.
Yeah.
Ever. They, yeah.
Where, and in all states, you know, if you're a billionaire, you can form a super PAC.
Yeah.
And influence the 11% of, or try to influence the 11% of people who are undecided.
Yeah. Okay. And then there's the president and the people who are speaking directly into his ear.
Yes. Okay.
So, I mean, there are very, very varied levels. Said very a lot,
yes.
But there are varied levels of access to resources, access to wealth, power, and prestige.
Okay.
So, what was I talking about?
Oh, gendered labor.
Gendered labor.
No matter what the society.
So, no matter what the society, there is gendered labor, and part of why there is gendered labor is partly because of childcare issues.
Yeah.
And so one thing about sewing is you can generally put it down at any point.
Yeah.
And walk away and then come back to it. Same thing with weaving, cooking to some degree.
Yeah.
Or preparation of food items, yeah. Preparation of the kill.
Yeah.
A lot of this can be walked away to deal with other stuff and then picked up later.
Yeah.
And so, with sewing, one thing I find is, yeah, I can turn off my brain to some degree because I have other things I'm thinking about, but if you shut off your brain too much, you mess it up.
I see.
Especially with the video game quilts. If you happen to put those squares in the wrong order, you have to tear it all apart again.
Oh, yeah.
And as is typical, it takes more time to fix up a fuck up than it does to fuck it up in the first place.
I understood, yeah.
So, you can't turn off your brain completely.
Understood.
You do need to pay attention. It does take some brain power to, you know, be able to do all the geometry
mm-hmm.
that you need to figure it out.
You think, though, it also is, and you talk about gendered labor, you know, it is also thinking about bodies as well. You think about the stowing thing is thinking about bodies and caring for bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Susan Bordeaux in her great book, Unbearable Weight, about, femininity in the body. She has a book called The Male Body where she talks about, you know, the masculine body in the Western tradition as well. The idea of, you know, the female is, you know, double body. It's the body that, you know, men desire, and it's also the body that takes care of you when you are either an infant or infirmed.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is that kind of, you know, the feminine double body bind that she calls it, you know, is thinking about bodies. So you think about when you're sewing, you're really thinking about the bodies of the people, right? You know, there's going to be a body under this quilt. Or, you know, I'm sewing this inseam or something. You know what I
yeah.
mean? Like,
I mean,
an awareness
when,
of the body. Yeah.
When sewing clothes, and when I was working in theater, I was a theatrical technician, and I was both a carpenter and a seamstress. So,
which is a very, very DIY making It's about making.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I love to create things, and I've always loved to create things. And I've loved to put things together since I was a little kid. And it, that's something that has stayed with me, that yeah. I get a little stir-crazy if I'm not spending enough time creating things and building things, even if it's spending an hour doing cross-stitch at night.
Yeah. Which I think, too, that's what I want to talk about, too, and maybe this is kind of the capstone for this topic, is this idea of the makers versus maybe the purchasers or the people who call people. You know what I mean? There's something to be said for, I'm going to try to figure this out myself. I got a book, I saw a website,
yeah.
You know, Make Magazine, I think. There's almost like a politics to that, right? I mean, whether it's a personal politics or maybe it expands to other things, that idea that people who are doers versus the people who can call. You know, and there was that great New York Times magazine cover article about the kitchen as showpiece for people who eat out and order out.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of like you, or the, or even the Daniel Harris book, Cute, Quaint, Hungry, and Romantic, where he talks yeah. about, you know, the rustic kitchen. You hide the tools of contemporary labor, but you have the antique apple core
yeah.
that you would never use. It's probably not even functional anymore, you know. But so you like hide labor. Or you outsource labor on a personal level versus those folks who like, yeah, let's just figure this shit out and like, I want to do stuff.
And that's always one thing that absolutely astounds me. I mean, because I did work as a seamstress, so I did have to think like how people fit into clothing yeah. and like, oh, am I making this too tight? Maybe yeah. I should keep it a little looser because it's easier to tighten something than it is to loosen it.
And also
but it always
would be how people move,
me.
Right?
I yeah.
mean, how movement.
But one thing that has come up multiple times is a friend of mine was one day he was like, I have to go to a wedding, but my pants are too long, so I'm going to have to stop at the tailor, and it's this thing that I have to do. And I'm like, I can hem up your pants. He's like, no, too much work, too much trouble.
Oh,
I'm like,
yeah.
no, it'll take 20 minutes, seriously. Put on the pants that you need to take to the tailor. I will fix them right now.
Yeah.
And there's that. I mean, and doing a hem is some degree of skill.
Yeah.
Because you don't want it to be too visible on the outside, so you have to make sure the stitches are very delicate.
Mm-hmm.
So I can understand why people would be tentative about doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are people who are like, oh, I have to go to the tailor. I lost a button. I'm like, well, do you still have the button? Yeah. It's right here in my pocket. I'm like, well, I have a sewing kit. Do you want to just sew? I don't know how to do that.
Yeah. Which that's a weird thing. I mean, I think people live in a world where all of these things, and these things are sort of like intimate parts of their lives. I mean, certainly the laptop, you know, everybody's mm-hmm. laptop or everybody's iPad is an intimate part of their lives, their TV, their car, where their food comes from, all of these things. But how many processes are sort of mystified?
Yeah.
Like how, and you write that reaction, people, oh, I wouldn't know how to do that. Or that's, it's amazing you can, you know, mix your own alcoholic drinks or something. You know, I got that once. You know,
oh my god, that's scary. Well, the number of people, because I have the food blog where mm-hmm. I come up with
I'll have to.
Recipes, mostly vegan pastry recipes lately, because that's just where I've been drifting. Not being a vegan, but I have trouble with eggs and milk, so I don't keep them in my apartment, even mm-hmm. though I can eat them in pastries. I just don't keep those things around, but I like to bake. So it's like when the cookie urge falls upon me, well, I don't want to buy a whole thing of milk because it's just going to go bad, that idea of waste again. So I started coming up with vegan pastry recipes. And I worked at a culinary school for a while, and I learned a lot about the chemistry of baking while I was there. I taught literature and sociology yes. and English, not the culinary arts, but I learned a lot while I was there. And so I learned how to come up with recipes and how to alter recipes to be vegan or to incorporate new ingredients that won't, so that I won't hurt that chemical reaction that happens when you're making pastries. Yes.
And we'll make sure to put the website on my website when I post the blog probably later tonight, which I think that's a great thing, because one of the things again, I keep bringing this up in classes, and that it broke my brain that I learned in grad school a little bit, is you think when you talk about cooking, you talk about the common sense chemistry, in a sense, that is making food,
yeah,
and reactions, and how do you make something fluffy. You know, which is something that I know is mentioned on your blog sometimes. Like, well, you had to substitute out the eggs and to get this texture, I got to put this in there instead. Yeah. Versus, you know, the Betty Crocker baking. And one of the things that broke my brain is somebody mentioned in the class, in one of my composition theory courses, how that if you get Betty Crocker or Duncan Hines or even Jiffy, you know, the front of a box of Jiffy hasn't changed. It's like, looks like the 1930s. Yeah. But the back now, when it comes to the ingredients, that there is, or the recipes, you know, there will be a picture of two eggs when it's time to put two eggs in. And this frightens me, is that the reason why they started doing that, reason why they started putting the pictures of the ingredients is... because people, especially for like Betty Crocker, Duncan Hines, the big ones, people would call the 800 number. How do you make this?
Yeah.
I don't understand. And, you know, and those directions are like one sentence directions. And it says something about adult literacy in the United States that we don't want to think about. That there's all of these people who are totally shut off, who like two eggs. What's that word mean?
Qualify here that these are native English speakers.
Yes, we're talking native English. We're not talking about folks from other parts of the world who maybe that helps them figure out how to make
Duncan
Hines too.
And I know people who are terrified of even doing a Duncan Hines box.
Yeah, yeah.
That they're like, no, that's just so beyond me. I will mess it up. I don't know how to make those things work. I can barely boil water. We eat out every night. And
yeah, that's
because I grew up in a household where I learned how to cook at a very young age.
Yeah, and I got to mention this too. You come from a family of doers.
Yeah,
you're all doers. You know, your brother is like, oh, I want bees.
Yeah,
you know, we'll figure out how to make bees work. And so he did, and I still have that honey.
It's so delicious. Unfortunately, they had as it's happening, colony collapse. And now they're thinking that it may be due to certain pesticides that are being used, and so that. And we live in my parents live in a very agricultural area, and it's like, well, that kind of explains it.
Yeah.
Crap. So my parents are, my whole family, my sisters both work in theater. My eldest sister is a theatrical designer. My second eldest sister does all sorts of crafts, but she's a props person, so she makes things for a living. And these things have to survive being manhandled by actors. And while I love my actor friends, some of them are not too gentle with objects.
Not too gentle.
They will. Some of them are very, very good with their props and very gentle with them, and may even be able to fix things if they break. But other ones, like if they will break things in ways that you didn't even think was possible.
There is that Murphy's Law to stagedom. I remember when I acted, and I just said a moment ago under my breath, actors aren't terribly bright. So I used to do it, so it's okay, and one of them I can say that. But
although I know some actors that I would actually want to see running the country because they are brilliant, but they're too smart to actually do it.
That, yeah.
But, yeah.
But that is, yeah, you almost do kind of feel, though, I think, some cases, if you just demystify the world that we live in and figure out how stuff works, it is this kind of amazing, you know, behind the looking glass, kind of proactive personality versus, you know, Zizek has that great thing about, you know, what he calls inner subjectivity, that, you know, the political debates happen for us now instead of having a public square where we go and yell at each other.
Well, even with the town hall debates, they have to approve the questions beforehand.
Yeah.
And if you go off script, it's because that actually happened in the presidential town hall debate this year. somebody went slightly off script, and it was like, they can't do that!
Yes. Or the sitcom, his example is the sitcom that laughs for you.
Yeah.
It's the comedy with the laugh track that, that gives you your own laugh. And that's just, I think, a different kind of humanity that we're moving towards.
Although we are going away from that.
You're right. Something has started to change a little bit, I think, with people.
And the first sitcoms that started pulling the laugh tracks, I think, really started in the 80s and 90s. And then the biggest one, one show that I wasn't particularly fond of, maybe because it didn't laugh for me, was The Office. That a lot of people loved The Office, and I was indifferent, apathetic even to it. And I did watch a few episodes. I'm like, it's funny, I guess. But they had no laugh track. And when the first shows started doing this, and I can't remember the first one, the very first one that did, the executives were very concerned. They're like, wait. You're not going to have a laugh track to this?
Are people going to know what to do?
Yeah.
Are people going to know how to figure this out?
They were very worried about that. And fortunately, it's becoming more common.
Yeah. Which I think is that weird, you know, thing, too. I wonder sometimes about, I don't know, how being a quote-unquote intellectual or a doctor of English or whatever isolates me from the world. But the best example I've ever heard of, like, people having to step in because it was just too hard. You know, the original cut of Smokey and the Bandit 3, the original idea was Smokey is the bandit. Because they couldn't get Burt Reynolds back.
Uh-huh.
So Jackie Gleason played both Smokey and the Bandit. And they test marketed it. And even though it was, like, different costumes, different cars, different personas, people couldn't get it. And so they got the snowman guy who passed away, I think, last year, the guy who played snowman, to be Bandit.
And you fast forward to the 90s, and how many comedies had the star in multiple roles? I mean, you think of Mike Myers playing multiple roles in Austin Powers. And before that, the horrible couple of Eddie Murphy films where he played multiple roles.
Oh, yeah.
The Glumps. The Glumps, which, I don't even know if that's the name of it, because I did not see it. And
whatever,
So, I mean, that idea of playing multiple roles, that we're more willing to buy that now.
All right. On that note, I think it's time for the bottom five. A series
of
questions.
We really didn't talk a whole lot about crafting.
No, we didn't, but this is only the first road episode. This is going to be the longest episode.
Oh, shit.
It's good. I think it's been really good. And we could probably go for another 2 hours, but who's going to download that, you know? Yeah. Even with the internet speed and give... I feel guilty sometimes how much time of people's lives I take. I know people now who call me, you're like, dude, I listen to every episode, you know, and my friends, and it's just like, oh, God, I feel like I'm...
Well, the longest podcast I listen to is an hour and a half, so...
Okay, so we're hopefully going to be under that, but you know what I mean, but it's like weird. Okay, so it's time for the bottom five, a series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. Are you ready?
Yes! Born ready, sir.
Born ready. All right, this is the one, and I keep saying I'm going to retire it, but as long as I have people on for the first time, keep doing it. If reincarnation is real, and you had to come back as an infectious disease or illness, but you could choose, what kind of disease would you be? You could be like a germ, microbe, virus. Like, you totally screwed up. Like, the DIY thing was wrong. The vegan pastries thing was wrong. You're punished in the next life that you come back.
I wasted too much water.
A single-celled paramecium thing that made people, like, puke or something.
Yeah.
Like, what illness would you be if you could come back as a... maybe not even a virus, but as a bacteria or whatever.
Well, the sexy answer would be, I'd come back as chlamydia.
Okay. <that's>
Curable by antibiotics if you catch it fast enough. but then again, the food part of me, although I'm very, very careful with sanitation in my own kitchen, I have fallen to this ailment a couple of times. So the food person in me almost wants to go, I'd want to come back as norovirus. You know, it's the stomach flu. It lasts a couple of days. You feel miserable. Hopefully you had something that you enjoyed that made you feel miserable. So it's like the godly punishment for overindulgence.
You see, that's the other thing is that that could go the other way. Because I once got a really bad stomach, gastrointestinal, you know, came out both ways sort of thing.
Probably norovirus.
And that was in like 2000. And the last thing I ate before it hit me was Boston Market.
Mm-hmm.
I still can't smell that chicken.
Yeah.
That was like a treat. Like, that was like a Friday night. Like, oh, let's swing through the drive-thru and get something. I can't now. And that was 2000. That was 13 years ago.
There is, this is actually kind of a cool one that I think would be kind of neat. It kills people who get it. But there is one disease that you get from, exotic seafood, so a tropical seafood, that can invert your sense of touch so that you feel cold as hot and hot as cold.
Oh my god.
Yeah. And I'm like, I can't remember what it's called, but it's really, I'm like, you know, that would be kind of neat to cause people to have that.
Speaking of which, I think I just last minute editorial, I switched questions. What's the strangest injury you've ever suffered?
Strangest injury I've ever suffered. Well, I broke my nose once. I broke a couple of fingers. But I think perhaps the strangest injury is the one that I bear the scar of to this day. I was at work one day and I sliced open my hand.
Ooh.
I sliced over the clipped my index finger and sliced down pretty much the whole length of my thumb.
And what were you doing at the time?
I was using the most dangerous, the tool in the toolbox that causes the most injuries, an X-Acto knife.
Oh,
I was cutting some mat board, and I have problems with my ability to grip hard, so my hands aren't, they don't function very well. They function well enough. I'm not complaining. But I have slight arthritis in my hands, so I have trouble gripping. And my hand slipped, and the knife, the X-Acto knife, shunk my hand. I ended up with 16 stitches in my thumb and 5 in my index finger.
Oh.
It was the only time in my life I've ever had stitches.
Ooh.
So, yeah, it's the one that's the most obvious. So, I think, you know, people who look at my hands, like, what happened to your thumb? Well, 16 stitches will do that. Funny thing with that, though, for 5 years after it, I couldn't feel the top side of the top of my thumb.
Oh.
It was numb.
Oh.
And about 6 years later, I remember I was sitting in my apartment in Pittsburgh in this very chair that I am sitting in right now. I was sitting there working on the computer and my thumb got burning itchy, like really, really itchy. And I started scratching and I'm like, I can feel that. I can feel. And the burning was the nerve endings healing themselves. And
how long did that last?
It actually did not last very long.
It
was probably like 20 minutes that I was like, burning, itchy, not fun. But I was just mesmerized. I probably scratched my thumb just back and forth going, oh my God, I can feel this. I can feel the pressure on the top of my thumb now. And it was just this very bizarre experience to suddenly be able to feel that portion of my thumb again.
That's strange. I was watching a lacrosse match, and one of our mutual friends said that she had a student who was a lacrosse goalie throughout high school, and he now cannot feel the front of his shins.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it's like, oh, they should probably have padding for that. So
he probably wears the padding.
Yes. So the next question is, what's your most irrational pet peeve? Is there something that sends you over the edge that really shouldn't, that makes no sense?
You know, I'm kind of a pretty chill person when it comes to other people.
Mm-hmm.
I hate it when other people are rude to especially in a restaurant, rude to service staff.
Oh yeah, that,
but I
yeah.
think that's a rational pet peeve.
That is rational, though. I've experienced that where I just feel like if you're eating with like a friend and you're just like, oh, they have an ugly side to them.
Yeah. Or even like if you're sitting in the same section as somebody and they're being rude to the very nice server who you're dealing with. That bothers me. I don't know. I can't think of anything offhand.
Okay.
I think that's a good pet peeve though.
Yeah. That is a good, and you're right, maybe the irrational part isn't, and it's just I'm insane, you know, and the one again, this is like the third or fourth time I've mentioned it for anybody who's for people who actually do listen, unlike yourself. You know, people who juxtapose the word scratch and itch. Those people, I'd murder them in front of their family. Like, No, you didn't.
You're
good.
Okay.
You're good. So, next question.
Could you scratch an itch?
I know. Yes, but people say I have a scratch and then I itched it.
Oh.
Yeah, exactly. That shudder, that's like fingernails on a chalkboard. Okay, next question. Two more. Okay, second to last one. The penultimate bottom five question. Here we go. What's the strangest item you have eaten and or found in your stool? Strangest thing you've eaten and or found in your stool, if there was ever a moment of like,
well,
did I eat that?
Does it have to be both?
No.
Okay.
It doesn't have to be both.
Well, I guess I can answer it both ways.
Okay. But just the weirdest thing, I guess, you voluntarily put in your gastrointestinal tract. Not voluntarily.
I don't know. I've eaten jellyfish. I like to try new things. I mean, especially, and I actually have, as part of my class, my students, because in my introduction to anthropology class, a cultural anthropology class, a lot of my supplemental readings are about food, and there's kind of this food theme that mm-hmm. goes through. It comes in and out.
Yeah.
Because my focus is food.
Yeah.
And so I have this extra credit thing where the students try something new.
Mm.
I'm like, try something that you've never tried before. I have them do a survey as part of it's completely voluntary. They do this survey. It's the fruit survey. I do it every year where they check off all the fruits that they've tried. I'm like, you can choose something from the fruit survey that you've never tried before. So every year, every time I do this fruit survey, I try something new. Every time I give them this extra credit thing, and I'm like, okay, this time it's jackfruit. I just tried jackfruit for the first and second time.
Jackfruit is pretty awesome.
Week. But I've tried jellyfish.
What's jellyfish taste like?
Very seaweedy. I think it was the flavor of the jellyfish was very much covered by the sauce that it was in.
Ah.
Which was, it was a seaweed salad that had jellyfish in it. So it tasted like the sauce that was on the salad. But the funniest thing that I found in my stool, you're going to cover this one. Hey, you asked him, might as well. I got up from the toilet one day and I looked down as I was going to flush and there was this fuchsia color, like this bright red color in the toilet bowl, and I was like, oh my god, I'm going to die, I'm bleeding, and I'm like analyzing this in my head, I'm like, where am I bleeding from? Because I wasn't in any pain, and you'd think if it was in the bottom, in the colon portion, what it was, I had been eating a lot of beets. It was the beets coloring the water in the bowl.
Oh, okay.
That had caused it.
Because I would say, because that actually is, I don't know if you know this, but, you know, they say coroners and, you know, medical examiners, you know, if you watch documentaries about them or whatever, you know, people, the two places if they die at home, they die, well, bed, of course, but the other one's on the toilet.
Yeah.
And if people have internal hemorrhaging, it'll feel like you've just got to take a poop.
Yeah.
So that was totally rational.
It is the pressure.
It's that pressure, and then you realize, no, you're dead.
Yeah, and like I was like, do I have a peptic ulcer? Because I was under a lot of stress. And I'm like, but it wouldn't look like that because it's going through the intestines and stuff. So going a little gross there, but you know, right. I'm willing to go there.
All right, last question. We're almost done, folks. If you could unmake any invention, what would it be? There's one historical invention you could unmake. What would it be?
Oh, there are two that I would say that damn, it would be great if neither of these things were invented. And they were oddly both invented by the same person. I can't remember his name.
Okay. But one everybody was, knows how to use the Google. It's like with that, like, hot cold disease. Yeah. Just Google it, people.
Same person. He was working probably, I think, for DuPont. When he came up with these two brilliant inventions. There was a problem that he realized. It was knocking in engines. And so he's like, hey, if we put lead in the gas, it'll stop the knocking.
Yeah.
That is one.
Leaded gasoline is really evil, yeah.
And he also invented fluorocarbons.
Wow.
Yeah. Or repurposed them. I imagine that they did exist, both lead and
chlorofluorocarbons. Chlorofluorocarbons. Now, and I know, we know why lead makes people crazy.
Yeah.
Now, why is the other thing bad?
Well, the other thing is it destroys the ozone.
Oh, that's right.
It binds to oxygen molecules. O1 or O2. What is the ozone made out of? It binds O3. To those. O3. That's what I was going to... I knew it wasn't O2, because that's what we breathe. I was like, is it O1 or O3?
And O1 is just stupid. O1's just dumb.
I mean...
It's like, hey,
it's in water.
Yeah.
Who needs that? But shit? Yeah, it binds to the O3 in the ozone and makes it no longer be there to protect those lovely UVs and stuff.
No, we're all gonna die. So,
So that's fun.
All right, I think that's about it. Thank you so much, Lisa, for being on. And your blog is called Eat It Lose, which
EATATLUS.
Yes.
At blogs, .blogspot.com. Yeah.
And I'll have the link on my site.
Cool.
Our next episode will eventually happen, and it'll be about something. Our homepage, where you can find new and old episodes, and the link to Lisa's podcast, or Lisa's food blog, is gonnadiepodcast.com. We're also on iTunes. Hey, sophisticated. Follow us on Twitter at Gonna Die Podcast, and we're all gonna die on Facebook and even Google+, because that's the thing that might eventually happen. Thanks to Brett Zork, as always, for the lovely theme music. Later, meets.